Today, we start with a fascinating mashup of, wait for it, the Oscars, artificial intelligence, Massachusetts, and accusations of plagiarism. At the heart of it, the film The Holdovers. So the set in Massachusetts flick had five Oscar nominations, one win. One of those nominations, Best Original Screenplay for writer David Hemmingson. And that makes the plagiarism thing all the more interesting. Now, we covered The Holdovers as a great See It for Boston movie when it came out. And now we're covering these unique plagiarism claims because they could affect all kinds of stories that you love in the future. So here to help us figure out if anyone actually done it, intellectual property law experts Peter Carroll and Bhamathi Viswanathan. Peter teaches at the University of New Hampshire's Franklin Pierce School of Law, and Bhamathi teaches at New England Law Boston. Also with us, film critic Ty Burr. He writes at tyburrswatchlist.com and helped us cover The Holdovers when we talked about it the first time. Peter, welcome back.
Thank you. It's great to be back.
Bhamathi, great to have you back as well.
Thank you so much.
And Ty, we've got you on the line. Hey there.
Hey there, Tiziana. How are you doing?
Great. Great to have you. Thanks. So Peter and Bhamathi, sit tight for a second and listen, everyone, spoiler alert, no way to have this conversation without talking through the plot of The Holdovers. So just heads up now. Ty, take us back. What is The Holdovers and roughly what is the film about?
So The Holdovers, it takes place in 1970 at a fictional Massachusetts prep school called Barton Academy. It is about a teacher who is long past his prime, who nobody likes, a classics professor played by Paul Giamatti, who is stuck over the Christmas holidays with a student who does not like him very much and vice versa, Angus, played by Dominic Sessa, and the school's lunch lady played by Divine Joy Randolph. And it is about their, primarily the teacher and the young boy, battling each other and coming to an understanding and revealing secrets about their past to each other over a lonely Christmas holiday.
So lots of acclaim for all kinds of dimensions. We'll skip the acting acclaim for now, Ty Burr. Remind us of the acclaim for Alexander Payne and David Hemmingson.
Well, Alexander Payne is a known quantity, really has been since Election. Many years ago, for Sideways, for Nebraska. He is a known quantity in making movies about comedies about difficult people, about Schmidt with Jack Nicholson is another. And this is very much in that line, comedies about difficult people that you warm to as they warm to other people. David Hemmingson is much less known. Payne had wanted to make a movie set in a prep school, but didn't know enough about the subject and got a pilot script for a TV show from Hemmingson set in a prep school. And he said, you know what, I don't want to do this, but would you like to write a film script for me set in that world? That's how they came together.
Okay.
So, and I, beyond that, I don't know anything about their working relationship.
Okay, Peter and Bhamathi are going to take us into the script issues in just a second here. One more thing for you, Ty Burr. Simon Stevenson is the claimant in the guild, the Writers Guild here on this.
Correct.
He says he had a film on the blacklist that this is too tight to. So just very briefly, tell us what this blacklist is.
The blacklist is it's supposed to be a secret list, and of course it's not secret anymore. It is the list of hot screenplays that are going around there, and it is published as a list. I forget exactly who publishes it, but if you're a screenwriter and you have a screenplay on the blacklist, that's good news. It means all the studios are looking at it or want to look at it or are going to bid on it. Sometimes they get made, sometimes they don't, but it definitely boosts career. So the fact that this is not just some random nobody, but somebody who has had this particular script on the blacklist, which means it's gone around to every studio and every producer in town. It's a known quantity. So this isn't just saying, you know, I wrote a script and it's been sitting in my drawer and Alexander Payne imitated it. This is something, and he has proven, he has receipts saying that the script actually was in Alexander Payne's possession.
So let's pull over here to Peter now. We're here in Studio 2. We're talking about Simon Stevenson's claim that this film, that this script for Frisco, which was on this blacklist in 2013, is essentially plagiarized, but not like word for word, but like concept for concept. Take us through that.
Yeah, so, you know, let's step back and talk about kind of what copyright law covers here. And usually people think of verbatim copyright infringement, which is when you kind of have a word for word, the dialogue is taken and ripped off directly. But that's not what we have here. What we have here is what we're going to call pattern similarities, right? Where the allegation by Stevenson is much more that things like sequencing and things like characters are one-to-one. And he even uses the word transposition, because it's not that this is exactly the same thing. Stevenson's account is not, a story is not set in a prep school. It's set instead at a pediatric hospital, right? So, but everything he is claiming to be sort of a one-for-one correspondence. And then the question becomes, at what level of generality are we going to see the similarities? And if it's enough to be what we call expression, we can still have a copyright claim, even though it's at that sort of abstract level of not protecting the dialogue, but really the patterns of the movie and the characters.
Amethy, you jump in now.
Yeah, think of it like music. So we talk about transposition in music. As somebody who studied music, I find this really fascinating when it's transposed to the literary world, right? The world of scripts. So plot points, are the plot points similar? How similar are they? Is the sequence of events similar? You know, this happens and then that happens. And how do you get from A to B? Are the transitions similar? Are the settings and the dialogues and the mood and the pace? Think about music, right? Do these two things sound alike? Are they just in different keys? But really, they have a very similar set of things governing them. So I think the question becomes, how close is close enough?
And, you know, it's interesting. If you look at it this way, like the way Ty was talking about it, if we just say these are two comedies about difficult people, right? That's such a high level of generality. We're going to call that an idea. That's not going to be protectable, right? But if we start adding layers of detail to it, we're talking about a curmudgeon who's in trouble with his boss for mistreating a parent who turned out to be an important politician. We're talking about a relationship between the curmudgeon and the 15-year-old that begins to thaw when there's a medical emergency. And then maybe we add that the teenager met a 16-year-old love interest at a set piece event they insist on attending together.
This is all from the summary from the claim.
Correct. Both, right? So the way that the claim is sort of laid out by Stevenson in his introductory document gives parallels at a pretty deep level of detail, right? And what I just read from you, according to him, covers both his Frisco and the holdovers.
So we've got Peter Carroll, Bhamathi Viswanathan, Ty Burr. We're looking at this accusation that the Holdovers, which was nominated for Best Original Screenplay, actually plagiarized another screenplay called Frisco, not necessarily word for word, but this broader structure. Ty Burr, I'm going to have you jump back in here. When I think of the last, 7,000 buddy cop films I've seen, right? So much of that structure is the same. So on the one hand, I'm skeptical. On the other hand, sometimes as I looked through the 30-page summary of the claim and the complaint, it will almost look like scene structure would line for line be the same. So what's your take on this, Tiber?
I agree. There are templates. And as a critic and as a filmgoers, we complain about how movies are so similar and how Hollywood sticks to these tried and true templates. This goes beyond that. If any of you have listeners are interested, and they can go on to Variety's website and Google up the actual 33-page document that the Frisco screenwriter has submitted. And it's very, just to a layperson, like myself, a legal layperson, it's quite well done because it starts with the general comparison and then moves into scene structure comparison and then moves into dialogue comparison. And again, if we are arguing that this is a conscious case of plagiarism, it's very cleverly done in that there's no word for word imitation. There's no word for word copying. What the statement surmises is that somebody copied, the Frisco screenplay into editing software and just changed lines and went through and changed everything, but basically kept the structure, the outline, and the beats, the story beats.
Bhamathi.
Here's where things get spicy, because I just cannot get on board with Ty and Peter. We completely disagree. Okay, so this is great. It's always great to have disagreements, and it makes more fun, right? So I just think, I looked at the Variety complaint that was attached, and I thought, yeah, you're making a good case. Lots and lots of things sound similar. But when you drill down and look at them, world-weary, older curmudgeonly guy professional bonding with young, troubled teenager, and then you see what a good guy he is and what a...
Officer and a gentleman.
I mean, seriously, how many plays have we seen? How many plots have we seen where it's like the buddy movie with the two people who don't get along get stuck, or three people who get put in a circumstance where they're stuck together, and then they eventually bond and things happen. Oh, the guy, the teacher throwing himself on the sacrificial, sorry guys, spoilers all over this episode, but, you know, giving up his job, forfeiting his career to help this one kid. I feel like Goodbye Mr. Chips and Goodwill Hunting, and let's make a mashup. And if I were selling this to somebody and saying, hey, greenlight this for me, you know how you do that, like, well, it's like Mr. Chips, but except with a bit of Goodwill Hunting, and then it's set in Boston, and we've got these, like, again, really bad fake Boston accents. It just sounds like it's all been done.
Okay, Peter, so Bomathy has thrown down on this. You want to jump in and respond?
Yeah, so I think this is probably better than your usual. I think it's important for our listeners to know that there's, in context, every time you have a major Hollywood movie that's successful, some people come out of the woodwork and claim that I had some interest in writing the script. This happens all the time. This one has more meat on the bone than usual, in part both because of Stevenson's professional history here, being a successful screenwriter before, but also because of some of the details I was talking about before. And I think that there's a world in which both what we're saying is true, that this is kind of a trope that is throughout all sorts of different, basically Alexander Payne's entire career is built off of making these kind of movies, right, about a curmudgeon with a younger character. But at the same time, it could be true that somewhere deep in his mind, he had this kind of read the script twice and was coming back to certain key elements that do motivate the drama. And I just want to say one last point on this, which is that it doesn't have to be zero sum. I think people very much approach this as saying, well, either it's his movie or it's a fake movie, right? Or it's a plagiarized movie. You can have a world in which there was a contribution by somebody like Stevenson, and maybe he should get a small percentage of a royalty as recognition of that, and maybe a writing credit, which is really what he's seeking at the Authors Guild, but not take anything away from The Holdovers being a fantastic movie that I personally loved and I thought was one of the great movies of
so
last
we'll,
year.
So we'll put Bomathy back in here, and then Ty, I'm going to come back to you to pivot a little bit to what this means for the industry and young writers. Go ahead, Bomathy.
Yeah, let's pivot to that. Can I start off with that too? I don't mean to steal your thunder, Ty, but that is a really good point. And to add to what Peter is saying, you know, attribution is so important. We've talked about this before when we've been on the show to artists, right? And that's one of the things that this writer sought at the Writers Guild. He didn't start out by saying, I'm going to sue you for lots and lots of money. He started out in part by saying, I feel that this has happened and I want some attribution. I want some credit. We know that's really, really important, right? But it's not all that's important. There's always money involved. I will say that in defense of the other side, it's very hard when you write a script and you have to show it to try to get it sold and get it greenlighted. And what do you do? I get asked this question all the time by creatives. How do I protect myself when I'm showing this stuff to people?
Lots and lots and lots of people.
Yeah, lots of people. And I can sign non-disclosure agreements, but in a company town like Hollywood, you know, I bring a lawsuit and I'm probably going to lose in the Southern District of California, which is a company-friendly town. So how do you protect yourself?
So Ty Burr, that is an issue here, right? As we read the coverage of this, there's also an unspoken rule, it sounds like, in Hollywood that you're not supposed to bring this stuff up. We don't talk about Fight Club.
Well, you know, if I may, you know, if Bomathy's going to be the critic, let me play the lawyer for a second. There is precedence here. There is, you know, the famous Art Buchwald Paramount case where he sued Paramount because of Coming to America.
The Eddie Murphy film.
The Eddie Murphy film was copied from an idea of his, and he won. And that was a real wake-up call for Hollywood. And you can, you know, also look to, the famous George Harrison case, My Sweet Lord, He's So Fine, where basically Harrison ended up getting, you know, but being found guilty of unconscious plagiarism. There is precedence. And I will say, personally, and I'm not a lawyer, but looking at this document, it's fairly damning that it's not just copying templates, copying ideas that are around, copying storylines, but literally almost photocopying the structure, scene for scene, beat for beat, point for point. That, to me, suggests that this would be a very interesting court case. It may end up with Thompson just, you know, getting the credit that he wants and a piece of the action. But I do think it's going to be a bit of a wake-up call for young writers to, especially as we move into the AI era, which is going to complicate things immensely, and which is being hashed out in various ways in Hollywood through strikes and other actions. And you know, how do you artificial intelligence is going to look toward templates, and things that have been done before.
That's the piece I do want to pick up, Ty. I'm glad you raised it, because that's the last piece in our remaining time here I want to pick up with Peter and Bhamathi, which is this AI piece, right? So you can say, take the idea of the Heat movie that took place here in Boston, right, with Melissa McCarthy and my brain is just not firing today. Anyway, female buddy cop movie, and put it in Alaska, Bhamathi. And AI would do that scene for scene.
Absolutely. What Ty is saying is that there's more to it than what perhaps the templates that you're talking about, Ty, that AI can do. And I think one of the questions that AI is going to leave us here with is just how much similarity are we going to have to find? We talk about this thing in law called substantial similarity, which is what you have to prove. You got to prove access and substantial similarity. Access is going to be an interesting question too, but it looks like there's some pretty good possibilities that they didn't have, in fact, have access. But on the substantial similarity front, yeah, the more stuff that gets generated, the more that you can extract, how quote unquote original do you have to be? That's an open question.
Sandra Bullock was the actress. And Peter, Carol, last word to you. You know, is this a dark chapter coming then, or just, you know, more of the same?
I think it's going to be different, actually. I think that there's going to be so much temptation to take a successful script and run it through some sort of AI, and out the other end, who would possibly recognize it? But you really are building off of that screenwriter's work. I think we're going to have to solve that problem, and I don't know exactly how we solve that problem.
But Didn't we always do that? Didn't we always do that? Look at the stuff that we learn from, and in our heads, we transform it.
Ty, dark or bright coming forward?
I'm going to say gray, and I also think that the first AI script that becomes a hit is going to change the calculation, and every studio is going to want to start making one. And that, to me, is dark for screenwriters.
All right. Ty Burr, film critic at tyburrswatchlist.com, Bhamathi Viswanathan, faculty fellow at New England Law, Peter Carroll, faculty director of the Center for Intellectual Property at UNH's Franklin Pierce School of Law. Thanks to all three of you for being with us.
Thanks for having us back.